This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Comté Cheese Association. Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comté-usa.com. That's comté-usa.com.
Hello, and welcome to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Elena Santigade. So there's really no good way to introduce this episode, I've decided. It's Monday, March 30th, year 2020, and here in New York City, we are on day 10 of statewide orders to shelter in place. Coronavirus is our new normal, and it has sent pretty much every facet of human existence into a tailspin, as anyone listening knows already. With restaurants mostly closed or doing dramatically less business through takeout and delivery, cheesemakers, importers, and distributors have lost enormous swaths of their business, seemingly overnight. Grocery stores are slammed, but shoppers aren't lingering in groups at the cheese counter, eager to try new local delicacies. Instead, what we're hearing is that folks are in and out of stores quickly these days and mostly buying Parm, Cheddar, and Gruyere, those sort of stalwart cheeses. Fellow Cutting the Curd host Aaron Foster is here with me today to talk more about how coronavirus or COVID-19 has impacted his independent specialty retail business located here in New York City, currently the epicenter of the pandemic. Aaron, usually I'm more enthusiastic about welcoming folks on air, but frankly, it's a little hard to be enthusiastic about much right now. So thank you for joining me on air today.
Yeah, it was a real downer. real slow play into that. I mean, you know, I'm accustomed to welcoming people onto the air as well now. So
that's true.
You know, I usually try to bring some fanfare in, but it's serious business, and we should be clear with people right from the top that there's not a lot of silver lining or good news in this podcast coming up.
Yeah, you know, thinking about our listener base, I think in thinking about how to do a show about what's happening right now in our industry, it feels most important to just commiserate, to share shared experience.
Yes, commiserate.
Let people know they're not the only ones going through what you're going through. So let's get into it. Let's hear about how things are going. My first question is that I saw that your shop in Bushwick, Brooklyn, is still open for business. So do you want to talk a little bit about what has changed in terms of like what that means in the new normal?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, as of 5:12 p.m. on Monday, March 30th, we are still open for business. Mm-hmm. That could change at any moment. But yeah, so we started looking at this thing in mid to late February. I sent in my first email and text messages to staff, I think probably in the last week of February, which at this point seems like an eternity ago.
Yeah, may as well be another year.
Yeah, and we anticipated certain impacts, but we didn't anticipate every restaurant being closed, there being a shelter in place, having to close our kitchen. Mm. I guess I'll just give you like a broad overview of kind of where we were and where we are now.
Mm-hmm.
Before this all started, we were coming into 2020 as a, let's call it, mildly profitable store.
Mm-hmm. Which is sort of a big deal in our industry, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I'll take it. And for those of our listeners who don't know me or don't know the store, we're kind of a funny little hybrid little grocery superette type thing. We have a full-service meat counter, a full-service cheese counter, a small kind of highly curated selection of groceries and pantry items, some fresh produce, a little sandwich and like breakfast biscuit burrito menu with about 10 items on it and like a full service coffee bar. And we do a little bit of everything, but we do it all in about 1500 square feet. So it's not large. A month ago, we had a staff of 20, including myself. I was not scheduled for regular counter shifts, and I was doing a lot of the admin. But I had 3 to 4 people in each department and a couple of porters as well. We were open 7 days a week from 8 to 8. And cut to today, I now have a staff of 11. Mm. We are open 9 to 6, Monday through Wednesday and Friday through Sunday, and closed on Thursdays. And my, well, let's, we'll just leave it at that, and then we mm-hmm. can get into sales and customers in a little bit. But that's kind of the very top level changes.
Mm-hmm. So that I'm sure we don't miss it, for I think especially our listeners who also own or manage shops might be interested in the staffing model you've switched to with the Thursday closure. Could you explain that a little bit?
So, yeah, I have a lot of doctor friends, particularly in New York. And one of them I was speaking to on the phone who was describing early incidents of infection on their staff and how they had tried to come up with solutions to, like, mitigate staff, like high staff infection rates. And they, I think the word he used was firewalling. I can't be sure, but he said that they were moving to non-overlapping teams. And so that one person on one team couldn't infect, while they could still potentially infect people on their own team, they would have zero contact and no one on their team would have any contact with anyone on the other team. Mm. So we kind of implemented this last week, at the beginning of last week, so we're now into our second week of it, where Monday through Wednesday is Team A, and Friday through Sunday, Thursday through Sunday is Team B. Mm-hmm. Thursday is a very skeleton crew, and they're there to just do a deep clean and reset. And then Friday through Sunday is we're open to the customers again, and no one on Team A can sort of see or fraternize or do anything with anyone on Team B. They can't come into the store on days that their team is not working. Hmm. And that's to firewall potential spread of infection on a single team.
Was it hard to implement? Like, in terms of, it sounds like your staff must have taken a cut in hours and schedule.
Yeah, so definitely. The way we kind of set it up is, so we had a number of staff we've been calling self-furloughing, but basically say, it's too dangerous for me to come to work. Mm-hmm. I don't feel comfortable. I'm going to stay home and not work. Mm-hmm. We had several people do that and several more at the beginning, and then kind of several more do it over the week this past weekend. But we basically have people working open to close, so roughly 10-hour shifts for 3 days.
I see.
So it gets them close. It's mm-hmm. probably three-quarter time, a little bit more, but not full time.
Got it.
So it was the fairest way to reduce everyone's hours without, you know, laying mm-hmm. Laying too many people off, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
But we did. So of the 9 people that are no longer working with us, I believe it is 1, 2, 3, 4. I think 4 of them. 4 of them self-furloughed. 1 is on quarantine, and the other 4. Were laid off, basically.
Mm-hmm. So you're a week in to this new model, to this new organization. How's it going?
It feels okay because we don't have proper weekends anymore. That is to say, we don't have like a busy day versus a non-busy day. There isn't really like nobody's kind of getting the short end of the stick.
I see.
So like, the sales are roughly equivalent Monday through Wednesday and Friday through Sunday. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the biggest kind of variation we've seen so far is weather-based more than anything else. Like, if it's nice out, people feel compelled to leave the house, even when they're not supposed to, and come to the grocery store. And when it's shitty out, people feel more inclined to just kind of stay in and abide by the shelter-in-place order. Although I will say that we are legally allowed to be open, and I feel that we do have a certain civic community duty to stay open. Although there's, you know, we can talk more about the sort of, I would say, like, ethical and moral complication there later.
Yeah, well, we could talk about it now. I'm curious, like, how you're navigating that, how you're thinking through those questions of the ethics of, like, being an essential business.
Well, here, actually, let me...
Yeah?
Yeah, let me say one more thing, just sort of to kind of paint the picture. So we've got these two teams. They're not overlapping, which requires a big change in communication. It's definitely hard. So two of my managers are married to each other, which means they're both on Team B. And then I have one other person also on another manager on Team B. So it's hard to kind of keep us all on the same page. We've definitely done some Zooming, which isn't super retail friendly. And I will say we closed our kitchen because we just saw a pretty precipitous drop in people coming in to order food. That was a very big draw. People just coming in for brunch and breakfast and lunch, and also people coming in for coffee. Our coffee business and our kitchen business has basically fell so far off the map that we closed the kitchen entirely, and we are doing a small amount of coffee.
Coffee was one of your larger categories, wasn't it, before?
It was. My two largest categories are now among my, they are the smallest. Coffee and sandwiches were my two largest, followed closely by meat. Sometimes they would all vie for the top. And now coffee and sandwiches are zero. Coffee is quite low, and meat is extremely high. And the other thing, other things we sort of implemented early before I think there were more clear government mandates and recommendations on this was doing a sort of one in, one out, six people max capacity in the store, six customers. And that was to protect the staff, reduce the number of people, prevent people from kind of breathing down each other's necks and overcrowding each other. And I actually went and painted, because I couldn't buy a paintbrush, X's out on the sidewalk every 6 feet to kind of provide line assistance, queuing assistance.
It's amazing how many people don't seem to know how much space 6 feet is. My theory is that there's a spatial challenge among New Yorkers, perhaps, based on what I'm seeing on the street.
We're all very accustomed. Very accustomed to just not... you know, being in up in each other's business.
Yeah, we haven't had the luxury too, you could argue. So how could we even imagine staying that far from one another? That's been a big adjustment on sort of a simple level.
Yeah, for sure. So that's, and then we also have numbers on the floor, six numbers on the floor in the store, 6 feet apart, measured with a tape measure, so that when people are kind of shopping and queuing in the store, they generally keep to a number.
Have you seen your customers be, like, extra aware of that? How are they handling it?
People are starting to learn. We definitely, over the first couple... So we've been doing that now for, I think, over 3 weeks at this point, probably. Or about 3 weeks. And initially, customers were pretty miffed about it. Didn't like being reminded to stand on the numbers. didn't really get it. We had some sort of deniers, COVID deniers in the audience as well. But these days, most of our customers that have been shopping with us remember to do it on their own. But we're also seeing a lot fewer of our regulars and a lot more new customers who we have to remind.
What do you think that's all about, that change?
I think I don't know, but I would guess that... people are going farther afield for items that they consider essential that are not available any longer or as easily in their wherever they would shop locally.
So the new folks, that's my best guess. The new folks you're seeing, you're saying, are maybe from other neighborhoods, not from Stone's
Throw. Yes.
I see.
Right. I think people are traveling a little bit farther afield. Most of the people in our neighborhood know us at this point. We were running at about 1 in 12 would be like our novel customer rate. Mm-hmm. 1 in 12, which like is fairly low. Like that was our kind of steady rate. 11 out of 12 customers were known to us in some way over the last 3 months.
Hmm.
Now it's like 1 in 5 is new.
Hmm. Interesting.
So that's more than doubled. Mm-hmm. The rate of new customers.
Hmm.
Okay. And yeah, it's and people are asking for interesting things. Like we've gotten a few requests for goat recently, and I think that's perhaps because people are either attempting shut in like new and exciting cooking projects, but also I think some ethnic stores that would sell goat, ethnic food stores aren't open.
Hmm.
And so people are having to travel a little bit farther afield.
Hmm. Are you selling goat meat?
No, we're not. It's not the time to take a chance on goat meat.
Just, you know, gauging how much you're able to innovate at this point.
Yeah, we have reduced innovation dramatically. I mean, that's probably worth mentioning too, is like we've tried to simplify our business model.
Okay, so what does that look like? What does that mean on the ground?
Yeah, so like with I guess the overview is, or the sort of top line is that with the closing of my kitchen, the reduction in coffee sales, the great increase in meat sales, the great increase in like grocery and pantry items,
mm-hmm.
and cheese is down or at the very least different. My margin mix, which is like a fancy way of saying like the money I make off of different department sales, mm-hmm. is just dramatically different than it was a month ago. So like, you know, the underlying regular cash flow mm-hmm. and profitability of my business is no longer like
in balance,
known to me
basically.
As clearly.
Hmm.
Yeah, yeah, and it were in balance, right?
Because I assume that knowing how you do things, I assume that you had basically a financial model that showed that if you had a certain percentage of sales from a certain segment of your business that gave you, that you aimed for, you know, a specific margin on, you're going to be okay. Like if you could kind of balance out your different levers, so to speak.
Right. I always think of like a soundboard or something like mm-hmm. that, where you're kind of turning up and down different things mm-hmm. and increasing the volume on one instrument and decreasing it on another
right.
to try to get to like a harmonious whole.
Right. And now there's like, would you say you're like, there's no model for what is happening?
I mean, maybe there is. I just don't, it's too early.
Hmm.
Businesses like mine, there's never that kind of super transparent visibility into like the finances on a micro day-to-day basis. Like there's always a lag while the kind of noise separates from the signal and you get a sense of what, you know, what the financials are and what your cash flow is looking like and where you're sort of bleeding and where you're fat. I would say like, I don't know yet. I know that the business that I'm doing now is lower margin, but I also know that I'm doing a lot more of it than I was before. And I just don't know whether the higher volume, lower margin makes up for the difference.
Right.
Given the other changes in my overhead, like my reduced labor.
Right.
You know, we didn't have a rent reduction. Sales tax is still the same. So my electric bill didn't go down.
Right.
My gas bill didn't go down. My insurance is the same. So it's like trying to understand whether all of those things kind of feed in and make up for each other.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a gauge on when you might know? Is it like you feel like a 30-day sort of...
30 days seems like a good starting point. I mean, mm-hmm. I ran my payroll, my last payroll, which was... a week ago today mm-hmm. and deposited this past Friday was the largest payroll I've ever run.
Hmm.
And that was crazy.
Yes. And that was on with 9 fewer employees.
Well, not yet. It was not with yet. Employees okay. that had chosen to leave or left, but still had worked the previous 2 weeks, which were quite busy.
Got it.
And so there's a lag, basically.
Right.
There's a lag of at least a week, but really a week plus 2 weeks. Plus, mm-hmm. so you, like, your payroll comes out, and then there's 2 weeks of people working, and then the next one comes out mm-hmm. a week later. So I will know basically a week from Friday what it really looks like, or much more what it looks like. But we, right. you know, we with the people that we laid off, there was not, they had not yet passed this stimulus slash relief slash, well, clusterfuck of a package. and so, like, I didn't know what kind of landing those laid off employees would have. So we did pay them out, like, basically a week of severance. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, I'm not sure. I don't, financially, that may have been the wrong move, but it felt like something I needed to do.
Yeah.
How are you? And frankly, legally, it's unclear what we're supposed to do.
Hmm. That was another question I had of, like, how are you figuring out the nuances of that package, how it relates to your business, how you can, you know, reap the benefits if there are any. How are you navigating
yeah,
that?
Yeah. I don't. So I have a call in the morning with our accountants who have said that they have perused the bill and are looking at options to take advantage of some of the, you know, the relief options there. So I should say something right off the bat. Like, we're at least financially fortunate that we're able to stay open. We have been quite busy. Just, I'll give you real numbers here because I can pull them up right here on my computer. But
I'm sure our listeners are going to appreciate
basically,
that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always would prefer to just be transparent about this. Mm-hmm. So the week, so not this past week, not the week before, but the week before that. So it would have been, pull up the calendar. Today is the 30th, so...
So the week of the 16th?
The week of the 9th.
Oh, okay, the 9th. All right.
Well, so the week of the 9th, we did 71% over last year.
Hmm.
So wow. It was a huge week for us. And in fact, the week before that, we did 25% over last year, which was, up until that point, our highest, like, year-over-year comp in well over a year.
Mm-hmm.
Then, so that was the week of the 9th. Then the following week, the week of the 16th, we did 50% over last year.
Hmm. And that was the week that the shelter
week,
in place
went into effect.
Went into effect.
Was in effect the whole week.
Mm-hmm.
And then this past week, we were down 12% over last year, but we were also only open 6 days.
Hmm.
And that's with our two of our biggest channels not operating.
Wow.
So we are still selling things.
Right.
And I don't want to sound like a whiner that, like, you know, our margin mix is all messed up and fakakta, mm-hmm. Because we are still in business. But it's a brave new world.
You're in an opaque moment on a business that was pretty transparent, I think it sounds like.
Yeah.
Like, right now it's like you can't really see what's at the end,
right.
at the end of this curve. Mm-hmm.
And I worked 20 days in a row, if not open to close. I certainly was open to close for, like, that last week.
Mm-hmm.
Until the team A, team B stuff started, mm-hmm. that was... I had worked basically 20 days in a row, and it was awful.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was Christmas. It was Christmas and Thanksgiving, and Hurricane Sandy, and everything rolled into one,
right.
except nobody gave us any advance warning.
you didn't see it coming at all. Yeah, exactly. Oy.
Yeah.
Well, let's do this. Let's jump to a quick break. We'll take our momentary break here in the middle of the show. And then when we come back, I want to hear more about your decision-making processes in terms of how long do you stay open? How do you weigh out the pros and cons of that? And we'll get more into that side of it.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Conte Cheese Association. Conte Cheese Association represents the Conte PDO, Conte Protected Designation of Origin, in the USA. Conte is a raw milk cooked pressed cheese from the Jura Mountains of France. There, every day, 2,500 family farms deliver milk to over 150 local cheesemaking facilities, or fruitiers. This milk must be transformed into Conte within 24 hours of milking to preserve the lactic microflora in the milk, ensuring the cheese's aromatic potential. About 105 gallons of milk are required to craft a single wheel of Conte. Conte takes time to acquire its flavors in the affinage cellars. After 8 months of aging by dedicated affineur on average, each wheel of Conte is graded and shipped to market. No wheel of Conte is the same. Its flavors speak to the pastures where the cows grazed, the season in which it was made, the particular craftsmanship of the cheesemaker, and the time spent in the aging cellar. Therefore, every wheel of Conte is unique. Learn more about Conte, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at conte-usa.com. That's conte-usa.com.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd. I'm Elena Santigade, and I'm here with Aaron Foster. We're talking about retail front lines of coronavirus reality here in New York City. And so, Aaron, right before the break, we had kind of like finished sort of sketching this view of what your business sort of what it looked like before, what it looks like right now. And I'm curious to hear more about how you are, how often are you thinking through the factors that go into your decision to stay open or not? Are you connecting with specific people about that? Are there resources that you're consulting? Tell me about your decision-making these days.
So I should say, like, again, I recognize that, like, that my business is in a privileged position of, mm-hmm. like, being sort of diversified and robust enough to still be open. Like, we're not a restaurant that was forced to close and mm-hmm. had to lay off all our staff. And we're not another kind of specialty store where, you know, our customers just aren't coming in anymore, mm-hmm. or they're not driving to us, or, you know, we serve enough of a broad swath of customers, and mm-hmm. we carry a broad swath of ingredients, so that we are, you know, we're very fortunate that we have the choice of right. staying open. Before I kind of get into like what that choice and looked like for us or mm-hmm. looks like for us, because we're reevaluating on a daily basis. I don't want to come off without, you know, sounding like I don't understand that, like, mm-hmm. we're fortunate to have that choice. Mm-hmm. So my situation is interesting. My wife she's employed. She's a lawyer. And so she's working. She's working a lot, actually. Mm-hmm. And her work has moved to working from home. And she's otherwise social distancing and being careful. Mm-hmm. You know, I am the big sort of, like, sore red thumb in our situation, because, like, I'm going in and interacting with 100 people a day. Mm-hmm. And for the last couple of weeks, it was several hundred people a day. Right. Because it was mobbed, even if you know, even if we were enforcing the 6 feet situation mm-hmm. and six customers at a time, I was still seeing people. And so, you know, every time I go to work, like, I'm putting myself at risk, but I'm also putting her at risk.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yeah, unfortunately, she's...
Think of it as this, it's this whole other dimension to any type of, like, people facing work right now. It's just, like, you're not only sort of considering your own health, but who are you interacting with at home? It's a big question.
Well, and then you have to think about third order interactions, like, or second, like, who are they
right.
interacting with? Like, if you go home, if you live in a roommate situation and you go home and your roommates have to go to their jobs, mm-hmm. Who are they interacting with?
Mm-hmm.
And so it starts to get kind of hairy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's something that, you know, my wife and I have discussed at length and repeatedly, which is, like, what are our risk thresholds? Mm. And
Have you found that those have changed? Like, are those changing over time, or have they stayed pretty solid?
They definitely change depending on mood. there's anxiety that changes depending on the day, depending on the news. I've definitely, like, gone to bed saying, you know what, fuck it, we're gonna close, like, it's too much risk. And then woken up and be like, no, that was too impulsive, and mm-hmm. and we can't do that. I've also tried, and I go back and forth on this, like, I have tried to bring my staff in to my head on this. Like, I've tried to communicate very, like, openly and clearly with them, and I've certainly, like, on more than one occasion just openly wept in front of them, which is maybe not, like, not the greatest quality of a leader, but
I think arguably it could be, so that's maybe fodder for another show, but
yeah, perhaps we can do a show on EQ or something, but it's been extremely hard, and laying people off I've never had to do. And it sucks, man. It sucks mm-hmm. so bad. And I know that it sucks more for the people that got laid off, but it still sucks. But, like, I would have regular meetings with my staff being like, you have to understand that you're assuming risk by coming to work. Mm-hmm. And that risk is not insignificant. And, like, not
in those
only
meetings,
are you assuming that risk for yourself.
Right. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, not only are you assuming that risk for yourself, but you're assuming it for your partners that you live with, or your roommates that you cohabitate with, mm-hmm. and anyone that they're in contact with. And, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, you need to get their buy-in on it. And you, like, you know, for the moment, like, if you guys don't want to come to work, like, I get it, and we'll close. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want you to, like, worry about me and whether or not I'm going to be okay. Like, I'm worried about you, and I don't want you to get sick, and I would feel awful and terrible if one of you got seriously sick,
mm-hmm.
or one of your roommates or one of your spouses.
Mm-hmm.
But I also feel conflicted about that, because some of my employees need the paycheck and yeah. don't have as much choice as I do, or some people on my staff do, in terms of whether or not they can afford to not come to work.
Mm-hmm.
Things are a little brighter or clearer or more workable with the stimulus/aid/clusterfuck package, but mm-hmm. like, it's still tricky, and it's still a difficult calculus to make.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like when you brought those conversations to the staff, had they already also kind of gone through this decision making kind of process individually, or was it kind of a first, whoa, we got to think about this in a different way moment for people?
I think most of my employees had kind of worked it out in their heads a little bit. But I made it extremely clear and explicit instead of implicit that like I kind of framed it like, imagine you will get sick. That the risk that you're assuming means that you are going to get this sooner than later. And what, you know, what that means for you. Like, you read the news, I read the news, we all have the same information. You know, is that a risk you're willing to undertake, or is it a risk that you don't have a choice to? And I told my employees that, like, if they, you know, if they really feel like they're only coming to work because they have to, like, come and talk to me privately, and we will, we'll discuss it, and I'll do what I can.
Yeah.
But, like, our finances are not dissimilar from, I think, most of similar businesses where, like, we work on, like, we don't have a war chest.
Right.
And we don't keep a ton of money aside for, like, rainy days. Our cash flow, I depend on, like, a busy weekend to pay next week's payroll. Like, I imagine most small businesses do.
And,
particularly in New York, where overhead is so high, there's not a lot of wiggle room. But we try to be there for our staff.
Yeah.
So I would say, yeah, they did understand the risks. I think they, to the best of their abilities, they all kind of listened and understood. And it was those moments that I tended to break down where it was just like, I need you to understand that, like, one of you gets sick. Like, not only do you need to be careful, both in at work and outside of work, because anything, if you don't behave and don't social distance outside of work, then you run the risk of getting us all sick. The idea of somebody getting sick and you know, experiencing real harm is the thing that I'm most afraid of. But I'm also balancing that against staying open at all and coming home and getting my spouse sick.
Right. Yeah.
So it sucks. It's a shitty decision. And, like, if we closed, you know, like, we'd lose hundreds of thousands of dollars, and I would, and it would be a real emotional blow for me. But, like, I would, you know, I would probably financially, like, we wouldn't be ruined. My wife and I, we would survive, and our investors would survive, I believe. Obviously, it's not an eventuality we want, but, like, it becomes a very, you know, I'm being extremely honest because it is a, there's just a lot, there's no right answer. There's a lot of emotional weighing and risk weighing, and there's just all this risk and all this uncertainty, and those are two different things. And we just, we're trying, it's like trying to kind of repair, like, rebuild a plane while flying through fog, and you know there's mountains around. But as long as you're airborne, you're still going. And do you purposely try to land and you don't know where your landing strip is, but you at least you know you won't hit a mountain?
Right.
Or do you keep flying because you haven't hit one yet?
Well, it does sound
like... It's not a real cheerful metaphor, but...
Yeah, but it seems true to life. I mean, it just does. And I'm thinking that a lot of people listening are going to relate to these feelings and that sort of day-to-day kind of, like, judgment call that you're making.
Oh, God. Every day I wake up and I'm like, is this the day that I get sick? Is this the day? You know, and every little tickle I have, I'm like, oh, God, is this it? Like, or it's like, oh, I'm just not sleeping and drinking too much and generally, like, stressed out.
Stressed, yeah. Doesn't help.
Yeah, it's like every morning I wake up and play the game. I was like, is it hangover or COVID? Let's spin the wheel.
Oh, man. And have another drink. Just.
Right.
Oh, God.
You know, and then I take out the thermometer. And it's like, oh, nope, just hungover.
Yeah, so are you taking your temperature regularly? Is that something is that something that you're asking your staff to do as well?
I am. I've asked them. I don't require it at work, partially because it's fucking impossible to get a thermometer or thermometer like covers right now. But I am asking. I mean, I have for now weeks now. I've said if anyone feels the least bit sick, they need to stay home, and I will pay them to stay home. They should not come to work. They should not be a hero. Like, don't. Don't feel obligated to me. Don't feel obligated to your coworkers. Like, we will figure it out. Although at this point, if once somebody gets sick, we're running with the staff we have now. Teams A and B are running with minimal staff, I think. I don't think we have any more room to lose people. So we'll have to reevaluate. Mm-hmm. And it's honestly, it's probably a when, right? Like when someone gets sick, not if.
Yeah, that's the grim truth, I guess, we're facing, especially here in New York at this point. Like, the numbers indicate that that's the phrase.
To recap, I sorry to interrupt you.
That's okay. Go ahead.
I feel like I'm hosting my own interview. I apologize.
Well, this is great. I think you're sharing a lot of stuff that people are going to be, I don't know if glad is the right word, but hopefully listeners, this is helpful to you to hear. So go ahead.
I hope there are shop owners listening that know that they're not alone. Like, I'm not on Facebook, and I did have like a really unfortunate Instagram experience where I was like oversharing and using Instagram early to kind of like, sound the alarm, but also like use it as my sounding board and my like online therapy tool, and just kind of using Instagram stories to talk about like the decisions, the difficult decisions we were making and what we were trying to do for staff. And, I had some hot takes that I think were at the very least, you know, a little bit privileged, and just unthought out, and took some troll flack for it, and just felt like it was no longer bringing. I mean, Instagram has not brought me joy for a long time, and I think in the time of COVID, I see this with other friends and family where it's too much. Mm-hmm. It's like a slot machine where all of the little signs, instead of bars and cherries, it's just like poison signs and skulls and crossbones.
I've limited my feed to basically National Geographic and the Shedd Aquarium. That's it.
That's smart. It's very wise. But I've I don't use Facebook, and I don't use Instagram anymore. We do. Somebody else at the shop is managing ours now. But I hope that people like shop owners and customers and other business owners just know that their experiences are like, I empathize, and a lot of us are in the same boat. It's really, really hard. So to recap, like, you know, we are still open, our sales are down, but they are not out. Mm-hmm. We don't know if we're profitable. We are running with a skeleton crew. We expect to get sick. And don't know what any given next day looks like.
Mm-hmm. One thing that brings us,
I think, to the relief package. Mm. Yeah.
Well,
sorry. Go ahead.
One thing we haven't really talked about is the cheese.
I'm sorry. And I always focus on the
Well, it's an interesting insight. It's an interesting insight, though, that I think that I've seen at least a lot of messaging and people kind of rallying around making sure we're still supporting local producers and finding outlets for softer, more perishable cheeses, and especially the cheesemakers that are relying on those to sell right now at the beginning of their sort of spring season. But it's, you have all this decision-making, all these factors weighing on your mind, and we haven't even gotten to the cheese yet.
Your
suppliers.
I totally just lost over it because I feel like, and maybe this, like, cheesemakers are going to hate me for saying this, but like, like the selection in our case right now, it almost doesn't matter.
Mm.
And it obviously does, right? It does. Like,
well, what makes you say, okay, so it doesn't matter, are you saying, to your customers right now and to you, basically, or who does it not matter?
I mean to me personally, but also to customers. Like I've had conversations with cheesemakers and with cheese distributors, and they're obviously suffering greatly, and I try to do my best to help them and buy things and pay them. My customers, I would say that our customers, and I've heard this anecdotally across the board, and I think you mentioned it at the top, like, people are just not down to experiment right now. They want brie, they want cheddar, they want Gruyere, they want Parm, they want Pecorino, and like, that's it.
Right.
They don't have, I think it's because there's so much stress and uncertainty in the air,
yeah,
and risk that, like, maybe this is just pushing it too far, but like, I think that people just don't have any more room in their brains to be mm-hmm. like, I'll take a chance and try this, like,
yeah,
you know, artisan American Tum, mm-hmm. you know, and spend a little bit more money on it. Like, they just don't have room in their brains for that. And yeah. their appetite for novelty is extremely low.
And I think it's also interesting, like, your customer price and their expenditures might actually not be as big of a factor in your shop, since it is a specialty grocer. It's not like a grocery store where sure. people are suddenly trying to do their full grocery shopping at half the budget.
No, my average, in fact, my average ticket has like more than doubled. Mm-hmm. Or almost doubled, I should say, since this started. And that's probably reflective of people not buying coffee and sandwiches, but.
Hmm. But it's interesting to think that those, that it's more of an emotional choice to, that folks are limiting the selection they're really actually looking at and interested in.
Yeah, I think it's a subconscious emotional choice. Yeah. Like, I don't think people are making it very consciously, but I think what we're seeing, or at least what I'm seeing, and I've heard this anecdotally again across the board, is that mm-hmm. like, subconsciously, as a nation and certainly as a city or geographic region, we've really kind of concentrated, rallied the troops, circled the wagons, whatever it is, around the tried and true standbys, the ones that hold mm-hmm. up in your fridge, mm-hmm. and the things that can be relied upon for recipes and mm-hmm. for snacks. And people also don't want to linger in front of the cheese counter and taste through a bunch of cheeses and have extended conversations through masks or through plexiglass or whatever at 6 feet distant. And I don't want them to.
Yeah.
I want my customers in and out. I want them to come to me less frequently.
Mm.
I want them to buy more and not panic buy, not hoard, but like, plan ahead and mm-hmm. come less often. And I want them to like get in and get out. I don't want them to linger. The longer they're there, the like the more risk there is of us infecting them or them infecting us.
Mm-hmm. It's a really good point.
If somebody makes their single trip to the grocery store once a week, like the only time that they're gonna interact with people is in our store, in a regular grocery store. But like, think about how many people the person you're interacting with has interacted with just that day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you might be social distancing, but then you go out and all of a sudden you're like 1 degree distant from someone who has many, many, many contacts, and you become a node.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like, I don't mean to be an armchair epidemiologist, but like it's pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
So. Yeah, I understand that like saying it almost doesn't matter just is so dismissive. It must be really painful for a cheesemaker to hear.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same and like obviously they're dealing with receivables issues and production issues. Like mm-hmm. you can't just turn off the spigot.
Right.
And if you have limited room, it's really hard. And aged cheeses have. Or fresh cheeses have like super low, short shelf lives and need to be sold or they go in the garbage. And hard cheeses, at the very least, you can like stack.
Right. Hold them a little longer.
Cram in and stack. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's some flexibility there.
Mm-hmm.
So I certainly empathize. It honestly, for us and our customers, like we don't have the bandwidth to like curate a selection mm-hmm. that. Is a little bit more interesting. And I don't think our customers have the appetite for it right now.
Right.
And I know that's probably not what, like, the little guys want to hear.
Right. And it also sounds like you're not trying to, back to that mention of innovation or, we haven't talked about, like, marketing or anything, but that doesn't sound like this is the moment where you're thinking about your marketing strategy or how to bring...
Right.
People's attention where you want it to go. It's more of like you're in reactive mode.
Yeah, I mean you don't want to open more fronts on which to fight, and frankly, like mental resources are pretty slim. Like I just don't have the bandwidth. Like I'm trying to get delivery up on and running. I'm trying to get pickup up and running mm-hmm. Without losing all my margin, which I've mostly already lost. And there's a lot of challenges there.
Mm-hmm.
And not to mention the ongoing like HR and health and safety challenges. And like,
mm-hmm.
and financial challenges. So it's like, so I don't have room to be like, here's like, I just brought in this new producer, like, come check them out. And, right. You know, it's just, it's not really realistic.
Right. So you mentioned that you are doing, you know, gearing up for pickups and delivery and online ordering. Do you have a plan for when you'll launch those components?
Yeah, I think it was last Monday I said I would do it. And maybe the Monday before that. And then I said today, and I think maybe tomorrow. I don't know.
What's keeping you from, like, pressing go on that?
So we're trying to do it all through Squarespace and not give it over to Caviar or Mercado or Grubhub or Seamless or these other kind of services. There are insurance implications. There are certainly huge logistical challenges in terms of how do you set up the ordering processes and fulfillment. We do a lot of random weight items, like how do you account for chickens or steaks or cut chunks of cheese? You know, how do you make it legal and fair and safe and cold and contactless delivery and refunds and subs and...
it's like a whole new business.
You know, packaging. It's a whole new business. And like and right now it's a whole new business with like limited resources, limited supplies. Like I can't just like... Right now it's I can't even get hot cold bags to like keep my product, you know, my chickens and stuff cold for delivery because everyone's out of them because everyone had the same idea we did. I mean, it's hard enough to get fucking toilet paper right now.
Right. That seems like one of the hardest things to get.
Yeah. And so it is my brain. I worked at Murray's and I do have like a fair amount of e-commerce experience and my brain in general kind of works in Excel spreadsheets and systems and to kind of just take this big, lumpy, somewhat inefficient thing that is my store and like put it up online and make a system that like generates more revenue than it costs me in like labor and headache to run it is daunting.
That's what's keeping you.
I'm stopping me.
Well,
it's
good luck with that.
Well, and you see this with other restaurants and all these places that like when the restaurants close in New York, they set up a system. A lot of restaurants were like, okay, we're going to pivot to delivery, and they did it for a week, and then they stopped because it's. Sorry, that's my dog sneezing. Oh, that's three. Nice work, buddy. They did it for a week and then they stopped because it's the labor just to turn on the burners and get everything going and bring people in and then do delivery. The margin you lose in the services, like it's not worth it.
Especially not with what looks like a medium to long-term reality. At the very least, it'd be one thing if it was actually a short term, oh, this is for a week or two or even a month, but it doesn't seem like that's going to be the case.
Right. Yeah. So, which brings us, I think, to the stimulus relief aid clusterfuck package. And I will say that like the unemployment guarantees and some of the like, It's not terrible. Like it does seem like there's a lot of giant corporate handouts in there, but the SBA administered forgivable loan program like has potential. So like I'll walk you through what it would look like for my business, and then I'll tell you why I don't understand how it could possibly work for my business. So like we're my margin mix has changed, so we're struggling, and like we could definitely use help. With our finances to get through. I am loath to take on more debt because I'm already servicing a large debt and you know, it eats away at most of my profit. And the idea of like taking on debt now in an extremely uncertain environment and I don't, you know, without knowing how I could pay it back is daunting to say the least. And that just doesn't make business sense to me. Now, historically SBA loans are like personally guaranteed and I would never guarantee an additional loan in such an uncertain environment for my business. Like that seems totally bananas.
Right.
What's on the table now is a forgivable loan that can be used to cover payroll, rent, utilities, and I think maybe healthcare costs associated with, with the virus for the next, I think it's like 3 months, basically, April, May, and part of June.
Okay.
And it would be a zero interest loan for that period of time, and then the amount that you use on those things that I just mentioned could be forgiven, provided that you end this period, which I think is like somewhere in mid-June, with the same payroll and number, like same average payroll and same number of employees that you started it with, like roughly like mid-February, beginning of February.
Interesting.
So I started with 20. I'm down to 11. A good chunk of those were either quarantined or self-furloughed and are like out of state. I don't think it needs to be the exact same people. The idea that like let's call it June 15th. I don't know the exact date, but it's somewhere around there. The idea that like my business, like our customers would return in such numbers that it would justify me rehiring the same amount of staff at the same pay rate in fewer than 90 days seems insane to me. Batshit crazy. And to make that the stipulation, and like I think it's like there's some arcane mathematical formula that reduces the forgivable amount based on like how close you get to that goal.
I see. So it's not an all or nothing
after that. Right. It's not an all or nothing, but I'll know more tomorrow when I speak to my accountants about what the language is and how it's supposed to work. Like the SBA hasn't actually issued formal guidance on it yet, although I think that's coming this week. And then there's like banking fees and other fees associated with it. So it's not like it's exactly free money. And then the unforgiven amount kicks in at like 4% interest, which is low, but also... Yeah.
Not nothing.
It's a loan that you right. And right. And to my as far as I understand it currently, it does not require a personal guarantee. Although again, like if you're gonna saddle your business with debt, like it's not ideal either way.
Right.
So I don't know. I would say that if my business is any like I just can't bring on people to pay them to stand around. I can't afford to, once we're through this period and I no longer have free money or forgiven loan money to do that with, like, then I'm in a situation where I have to like lay people off again. So there needs, I think there's going to have to be some tweaks.
Right.
Like if, you know, otherwise it's like, okay, I rehire, I'm expected to like, not only rehire people, like, I've lost a lot of people that are trained, so if I can't rehire the same people, then I have to hire and train new people to do business that like isn't necessarily going to be there, because I don't think people are going to be out and about exactly in 2 months' time.
Yeah, it seems highly unlikely, at least here.
Yeah, I think we'll probably be over the hump by June in terms of like peak infection rate, but we'll, you know, that social distancing will keep that number manageable. I mean, it's going to get unmanageable in the next 7 to 10 days and get really bad in the next 14 to 21. And then after that, probably start to come down again. But like, I think you'll see like restaurants be able to reopen with half max capacity again. And same with bars. And, there'll be some societal herd immunity that should help reduce, you know, hospitalizations. But like people are going to keep getting sick. It's not just going to disappear, and there's not going to be a vaccine in that time. So, I guess the point of that is that there's just so much uncertainty, and while a grant, which is essentially what a forgivable loan is like super promising. I think that's the right call. And that's like something that in theory could be really good for quote-unquote mainstream America, and I recognize that I have very little in common with mainstream America and my mm-hmm. business, nor does my business, but like, or Main Street America, I should say. Mm-hmm. Main Street USA, that's
there, that's it. For. Disneyland classic.
Yeah. Yes. But I as it stands now, like it's a promising first step. And I think the unemployment that they put into place is super, super robust, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. Although I'm hearing anecdotally that it's nearly impossible to actually file right now. Mm. So, yeah, I don't know. They're going to have to do something because unemployment numbers that are going to come out next month are going to make even this month seem
small,
which we're already something like 4 or 5 times the previous high.
Yeah.
Are going to be even way, way, way larger.
Yeah. It's like your 30-day wait on your bottom line. It's like the government is this similar thing with the unemployment numbers. It's like, we know it's coming, but we have to wait.
And I actually, I filed, like, we were randomly selected to file with the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, our hiring numbers, like, a couple years ago, and we file every month. It's annoying, but we do it. Mm-hmm. And so those jobs numbers that come out every month are, like, we actually contribute to those job numbers. And, like, I know for a fact that the numbers I filed at the end of March, because it's for the 12th of each month. Like our numbers did not include the layoffs or self furloughs, and won't until for another 2 weeks from now.
Wow. That's really interesting.
So we, you know, at the last numbers we reported, we still had 20 people on staff. Whereas the next, if we're still open, well, you know, we'll have 11 max.
Wow. Very, very interesting insight. I'm going to pivot as we get to the end of this sort of bonus extended episode we're doing today and ask you what, if anything, is helping you to cope?
Oh, alcohol. if I'm being perfectly honest, like,
yeah,
I had socked away some nice bottles. I think we're pretty much at the end of all of my nice wine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we spoke like in preparation for the show, and I was just like, you know, if now is not the time to drink your good wine, I don't know when is.
Right. It's such a good point.
And, you know, the occasional Xanax helps, particularly in moments where I'm like kind of crippled by like self-doubt or fear or you know, woe. Mm-hmm. Although I think probably I should be saying exercise and yoga you know, therapists.
I wouldn't but, like, believe you if you listed quite those as your top three.
that says a lot about me, I think.
How about connecting with other people? Like, have you, you know, you mentioned that you've had a lot of doctor friends. I imagine even just hearing about it's not uplifting by any means, but it's in terms of kind of perspective and being supportive.
You know, I talked to a few people, you know, today is my 5th wedding anniversary.
Happy anniversary.
And we had plans. Thank you. We had plans to go to a nice dinner and, that obviously isn't happening. And so she's going to cook our favorite, well, my favorite dinner, I guess, which sounds extremely heteronormative. Now that
Aaron.
We're going to, and maybe do like a happy hour with her coworkers and talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
When I talk to her coworkers who are all like working remotely, but very busy and are going to be fine. They're all like, I don't know. They tell me that I'm doing good work staying open, and that even though I own a bougie grocery store and cheese shop, like, it's important. It brings people a sense of normalcy, and it brings people a sense of routine, and is a glimmer of like positivity in an otherwise pretty dark time. And so, you know, it's hard for me to, I don't take compliments well, but it's nice to hear that. And I would say that our customers have generally kind of reflected that view as well. Like, there's one couple with a new kid who they make our shop as their only outing of the day, and they come in, they get a cup of coffee, they leave, and it's, you know, they thank us for being open, and that's like incredibly meaningful.
Yeah, I think that connection is like at the heart of why do retail at all, you know, on some level.
Yes, and I've always loved the hospitality side of this business, but coping, honestly, like, you know, talking to other people that are in the same boat. I've been speaking to Bianca, who owns Mermaid's Garden Fish Shop, Aaron Campbell, who owns Campbell Cheese, been talking a little bit to you know, Mateo up at Jasper Hill, Ann Saxelby, and just, you know, we're all in different boats, but it's at least nice to know that, like, we've all got holes in our boats, and there's, you know, misery loves company, and so to that extent, it's a little bit, nice is not the word, but comforting, maybe.
Yeah, the shared experience, you're not alone. Whether it's good or bad, yeah, I think it's important. And I think that's part of, I don't know, maybe that's a good final sentiment for the show today. Listeners, we hope that this was helpful, if not our most uplifting show we've ever done. But hopefully those of you out there who are experiencing this on either side of the counter or the cash register, you know, we hope this insight was helpful.
And if anyone wants to reach out to me personally, we've always been quite open book about what we do. And I would never pretend to say that what we're doing is like the right solution or the best way to do something. But I'm certainly happy to tell you how and why we chose to do it the way we do it. And I'm open to suggestions and commiseration, and I'm just foster@fostersundry.com.
Great. Thank you so much, Aaron. Thanks for sharing and really opening up about this whole experience. I think it means a lot.
Well, I appreciate you having me on, and I hope our listeners, we know it's downer, but we thought it was important to share, and just keep fighting the good fight, and if you're seriously, it's depressing, and so, like, if you were really struggling, like, reach out to somebody. That's hard. Yeah. And I don't know if we'll be open tomorrow or next week, but we're open now, and that's something. So I appreciate you having me on, and keep on, to everybody, stay safe and stay healthy. It's crazy out there.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everyone. We will be back next week with more Cutting the Curd.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.